The March of Time. Tonight, Remington Rand, world's largest manufacturer of office equipment, again takes pleasure in asking the men they consider to be the ablest historians of our day, the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, to present their reenactment of memorable events from the news of the world, from the March of Time. The United States, with summer nearly over, with congressmen speeding home from the hot work desks in the Capitol, the political merry-go-round starts up for the big 1936 ride.
If the Republicans put up their strongest candidate, Senator William E. Borah, I'd support him. I tell you here and now that Franklin Roosevelt will not be the next president of the United States. If the Democrats nominate Roosevelt and the Republicans name Hoover, Huey Long will be your next president.
Thus, Louisiana Senator Huey P. Long in New York. In Los Angeles, California, political reporters watching developments in what may prove a key state. Question two of a dozen men emerging from an office.
Any statement, Mr. Farley?
Nothing to say, nothing at all. Just here to meet the boys, that's all. No statement. Goodbye.
Oh, Mr. Sinclair, have you anything to say, please?
Well, boys, politics isn't private. I'll tell you, Mr. Farley hasn't changed since last year. He now sees the views of the liberal Democrats. Our side, my EPIC, has the Democratic votes for California. The right-wing leaders have the money. Farley wants them both. Perhaps we can trade votes for an epic plank on the Democratic National Platform next year.
The nation notes that President Roosevelt's political fence mender, Postmaster General Farley, is arm in arm again with Upton Sinclair, whom he repudiated last year. But biggest political news of the new season comes today from the baronial castle at San Simeon, California, from William Randolph Hearst.
I do not know who will be the nominee of the Republican Party. I suppose Mr. Roosevelt will be the nominee of the Socialist Democratic Party. But even that is not a certainty. I do not know what party I will support. I will say, however, that I think there should be a Jeffersonian Democratic Party in the field with a platform of sound democratic principles. The present Democratic administration has adopted all the socialistic principles. It's not for me to decide who should be nominated on the genuine Jeffersonian Democratic ticket, but I think Alfred E. Smith would make a powerful candidate. He is the accredited leader of the genuine Democratic Party. He was their latest presidential candidate. His principles are the historic principles of the party. In the coming election, we are not merely electing a president. We are saving America.
With this astounding political pronouncement, newspaper potentate Hearst, whose mortal hate and fear of Smith goes back to 1919, asks the happy warrior, his political foe, to lead a new Democratic Party in outright revolt against the New Deal. Time marches on. New York City. In Willard Parker Hospital, one day a year ago, Dr. William Halleck Park, director of New York City's research laboratory, hurries to the workroom of his assistant, Dr. Maurice Brody.
I got your message, Dr. Brody. You have something new?
I think so, Doctor. I believe I found the thing we've been looking for, a way to prevent infantile paralysis. What I have here is a vaccine that will give permanent immunity.
How do you make it, Dr. Brody?
By grinding up the spinal cords of rhesus monkeys which had been injected with paralysis virus and then treated with formalin to kill the active paralysis germs.
Have you tested this new vaccine yet?
Yes, on mice and monkeys. My tests proved beyond doubt that these injected animals are definitely made immune to paralysis by injections of the vaccine.
But can it be given to human beings without harmful effect?
Well, that's what we must find out, Dr. Park. I propose to try this vaccine on myself immediately.
I'll be glad to take the injection also, Dr. Brody.
Good. If the vaccine doesn't harm us, we'll be ready to put it to a real test next summer, when the 1935 paralysis season starts.
Dr. Parks and Dr. Brody take injections of the new infantile paralysis vaccine with no ill effects. The 1935 summer infantile paralysis season makes news when an international scout conclave of 27,000 boys is canceled, when Annapolis cadets and enlisted men are prohibited from entering the states of North Carolina and Virginia on their vacations, and when Boston and New York consider delaying opening their public schools. But even bigger news this summer is the new vaccine, which is being given to hundreds of children in California, North Carolina, and Massachusetts. Typical of his war against the dread disease is the scene today in the hospital at Fall River, Massachusetts.
Nurse, will you bring the children in?
Just come in here, all of you.
Nurse, are the slips of paper ready for the children to draw?
Right in that box, Doctor.
Thank you. Quiet, please, children, while I explain what I'm going to do. I want you all to form a line and walk past this box, and each of you take out one of these slips of paper.
What's on the slips of paper, Doctor?
Some have cross marks, the others are blank.
Which kind are the lucky ones, Doctor?
They're all lucky. Those of you who get cross marks will have the vaccine injections. The others will not. This vaccine is something entirely new. Nobody knows whether it will keep you from getting paralysis or not. The only way we can find out is to give some of it to you and not to the others. You children are taking part in a test that may save thousands of lives in the future. All right, nurse, bring them up.
Thus today, Fall River's children draw lots. Tonight, in his New York office, Dr. Brody describes the importance of his nationwide experiment.
We have vaccinated thousands of children in areas where the disease is most prevalent. Within the next month, some of the vaccinated children are likely to be exposed to the disease. If none of the vaccinated children contract the disease, we will know we've found a vaccine that gives complete immunity against infantile paralysis.
Time marches on. Moscow, Russia.
Jan Otmar Bersen, your reports to your newspaper in Poland concerning the 7th Congress of the Soviet International are an insult to the Soviet government. You are given exactly 72 hours in which to leave the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics.
In less than 72 hours, Polish correspondent Bersen, hurrying across the Russian border, arrives in Warsaw, goes straight to the editor of his newspaper.
Well, that Congress of the Comintern in Moscow has certainly become world news since they threw me out.
You mean because of the United States note?
Exactly. I say the whole world should be grateful to the United States for calling attention to the spreading of Soviet propaganda abroad. You know, they threw me out of Russia because I called the Comintern the most lying institution in a country which has the world's record for lying. But their reply to the United States note...
Soviet government saying they could take no responsibility for the Communist International.
The best one yet. Why, Stalin is not only a member of the Comintern, he opened their meeting in person and told them what?
Correspondent Bersen's violent opinions, which caused his expulsion from Russia, comprise only one of the many protests, both official and unofficial, brought against the Communist International 7th Congress just closed. Today, in defiance of the world censor, the official resolutions adopted there are broadcast from Communist headquarters at Moscow.
Workers of the world, unite! Assume the offensive in your struggle to supplant existing governments by revolution. First, walk toward the united front against fascism. Arouse the masses. Instruct the masses how to defend themselves against fascism and capitalists. Sabotage preparation for imperialist war. Undermine the middle class and strengthen the proletariat. The proletariat can overthrow them, but continued struggle is necessary.
So today, with this official manifesto, the Communist International adds an open affront to the diplomatic defiance of the Soviet government's note to the United States. And the world still waits to hear what Washington will reply to Moscow. Time marches on. I, Leopold, do swear to observe the Constitution and laws of the Belgian people, to maintain their national independence and the integrity of their territory. I assure my countrymen that on this day I give myself entirely to Belgium, and that my Queen will aid me with all her heart in the accomplishment of my duties.
Thus, 18 months ago, in a Belgium saddened by the death of its King Albert, a new king, his son, ascends the throne. After the coronation ceremony, the new king and queen, her hand on his upraised hand in traditional royal promenade, come slowly down the great winding staircase of the palace.
My voice shake, Astrid?
No, Leopold, not a bit. I was so proud of you, and so proud to be your queen.
Astrid, careful, you almost fell.
Leopold, I'm so sorry. My heel caught in this train. Will you forgive me?
Of course. I don't think anyone noticed, Astrid. Anyway, you couldn't help it. But it's very bad luck, you know.
Bad luck?
Oh, yes. An old royal tradition starting way back with William the Conqueror. You know, one of those superstitions about ceremonies like dropping the ring at your wedding.
We didn't do that anyway. I think our luck's going to be all right, Leopold. Don't you?
Early this morning, a family of Swiss peasants walking to their fields down a road that winds along the shore of the beautiful Lake Lucerne, high in the Swiss Alps near Zurich, step aside at a slight curve to let a big black car pass. They turn suddenly as the big car screeches into a skid, lurches over the rocky embankment. Down, horror struck at the wreck, they see only the figure of a slender young man. It is King Leopold III, kneeling dazed and silent beside the body of his dead wife, Astrid, Queen of all the Belgians.
Time marches on. You have just listened to The March of Time, the reenactment of memorable scenes from the world's news, prepared and presented by the editors of Time.
From every part of the world, by news, cable, direct wire, radio, the editors of Time collect important facts for The March of Time. From every part of the world, Remington Rand collects business facts that form a background of knowledge for more than 2,200 trained field representatives. Would you like to know about new efficiencies in accounting? Remington Rand makes all types of accounting, adding bookkeeping machines, including the famous Powers punched card accounting equipment. Our representative can give you unbiased information on important new testing methods. Someone has said that anyone can file a letter, but it takes a very good system to find one. Remington Rand is the world's largest manufacturer of filing and record systems and equipment. One of our representatives will gladly analyze your particular requirements, giving you impartial recommendations. What about typing costs? Actual tests prove that the famed Remington Noiseless or other Remington models specially equipped for the particular job can cut typing costs from 14 to 19%. Typewriter ribbons, carbon papers, duplicating stencils, portable typewriters and supplies. Remington Rand makes all, services all, through direct branches in your own city. Telephone our local office. Scientific tests prove that the child with a typewriter does better schoolwork. See the complete line of Remington portables at the nearest typewriter dealer. Or wire for a catalog to Remington Rand, Buffalo, New York. Convenient monthly term.
Again tomorrow night at this time, and every night, Monday through Friday each week, The March of Time will take you to the world's news fronts, to the sides of the great and the humble, into the midst of events significant and strange, stirring and tragic, in the pace of time's inexorable march. Time marches on. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. WABC, New York.